Hello, and thank you for tuning in. You are listening to BiteRadio.me's Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. For network or show information, visit www.BiteRadio.me or call 843-808-0777. And now, the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show with your host, Robert Sharp.
Good day, everyone, and thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Today, my very special guest is Frank Schaefer. He is author of Why I Am an Atheist Who Believes in God, How to Give Love, Create Beauty, and Find Peace. Caught between the beauty of his grandchildren and grief over a friend's death, Frank Schaefer finds himself simultaneously believing and not believing in God, an atheist who prays. Frank wrestles with faith and disbelief, sharing his innermost thoughts with lyricism that only great writers of literary nonfiction achieve. Frank writes as an imperfect son, husband, and grandfather whose love for his family, art, and life triumphs the ugly theologies of an angry God and the atheist vision of a cold, meaningless universe. Frank writes that only when we abandon our hunt for certainty do we become free to create beauty, give love, and find peace. Frank's book is available from Amazon.com, and I do have a direct link to his book there in the show page description. So with that, I'd like to welcome Frank to the show. Good day, Frank. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me on.
It is my pleasure. I enjoyed reading your book, and I'm going to be recommending it to a few people I know.
Thank you.
To add some perspective, it was. I really, really liked it. So I'm looking forward to our discussion. But I'd like to start with many of my listeners probably aren't familiar with your family's history.
Sure.
and connection to the evangelical world. So if you wouldn't mind, would you kind of give us a little bit of that background so we can get some perspective?
Yes, not at all. Well, let me start backwards. I'm 62 years old, and I've been married to Jeannie for 44 years. I have three grown children and five grandchildren, one of whom, Lucy, who's six, I just picked up in first grade about 10 minutes ago. So that brings you totally up to speed. But
okay.
Moving on from there, I grew up in Switzerland in a small evangelical missionary outfit called Labrie Fellowship, started by my parents, Francis and Edith Schaefer, back in the 50s. And when Dad went over there at the end of World War II, he was an obscure, unknown, fundamentalist Protestant missionary with the Presbyterians. By the time I was a teenager, Labrie Fellowship had grown. There were about eight buildings, a couple hundred students there at any given time, and we had people like Billy Graham and Jerry Falwell and others would come by and visit, and all of a sudden Dad was a leader in the evangelical movement because, unusually for that time, he took a great interest in popular culture, and so a lot of younger people, students and others, including many people who didn't come from evangelical backgrounds, who were hitchhiking around Europe in the 60s and 70s and traveling to places like India to go to ashrams and all this kind of spiritual seeking, would stop by. And so in my middle childhood and through my teen years, I was in a very happening place, stepping over sleeping bags at night, people crashing in the house, living in our home. It was filled up, a constant flow of famous evangelical types like Billy Graham, who would come by for dinner and talk with my dad. And then in the 1970s, after I got my girlfriend Jeannie pregnant, that's 44 years ago, we were 17 and 18, in an evangelical fundamentalist mission, so that was an interesting experience. A while later, we got married, and we still are, and we have these kids, and it's been a long time. I don't know who those crazy guys were, but we are very much together, so that's been good. But I needed to earn a living, to be blunt about it, because I was, as a painter, an artist, I was selling some work, but hardly earning a living to support a child, and then a second one on the way. And a well-known evangelical movie producer came by and visited my parents' ministry. His name was Billy Zioli. He was from Gospel Films, a kind of mission outfit that used movies to reach people for Christ, as he would have put it, and funded by the right-wing, very right-wing people, Rich DeVos and Jay Van Andel, who were the founders of Amway, and then Rich DeVos's family went on and founded Blackwater, the security firm that got such notoriety for their criminal behavior in Iraq. And so all of a sudden, here was this obscure missionary family lifted up to celebrityhood in the big evangelical world. And, you know, as I say in the book, the only other places where you find the level of nepotism that's in the evangelical world, where father and son or daughter or wife or everybody else gets on the cart here and into the God business, I guess, is in the mafia or the British royal family. So I spent my late teen years, my early 20s until I was almost 30, running around America as Francis Schaeffer's sidekick with C. Everett Koop, who went on to be Surgeon General for Ronald Reagan. And when we were in Washington, my parents would often stay in the White House if there was a Republican there, or I would stay with Jack Kemp, who was Bob Dole's running mate and a congressman at the time. And we were really hock deep in the religious right. So that takes me up to 1984, when my dad died. I was almost 30. And I just kind of sat down and really looked at my life. And by that time, I had kind of learned what the religious right was really all about, the kind of bigotry and politicizing of faith, the kind of lashing out at people like the gay community and others. I had wanted to be an artist. In fact, the Labrie community back in the day when I was a teenager, before my dad got into issues like the abortion issue and the anti-abortion issue and all the rest of it after Roe v. Wade, was really known for arts festivals and welcoming all sorts of people. And the religious right that we were in at that point was out of all character to what I had known. And we were literally, I was literally in my mid-20s flying around in Jerry Falwell's borrowed jet, doing things like being the keynote speaker at the Southern Baptist Convention. And I was really like a fish out of water, and worse yet, I was very good at it. I'm a good public speaker, and so people were putting their hands on me and saying crazy things like, the mantle has passed, you know, we know that you've been led to do this, you're going to be another great voice for God, and so forth and so on. And at the same time, I was really losing my faith in both the religious right as a movement, but also my faith in God completely, because, you know, like Groucho Marx, who said he wouldn't want to be a member of any club that would let someone like him join. You know, here I was being projected as a leader in the religious right, and I was believing less and less, and I realized that half the people I was involved with were kind of flakes who were faking it for the money, were losing their faith rapidly with their celebrityhood and so forth. So in the mid-1980s, I journeyed out. I got out and lost a lot of money because that was a good income. I've never earned such money since. And first of all, I schlepped around Hollywood. I cut a reel from my documentaries that I'd made, like How Should We Then Live? I'd made with my dad, and Whatever Happened to the Human Race, which was the documentary series and book of the same title that really founded the religious rights Protestant part of the anti-abortion movement. And I had enough good directorial stuff in there, so I got an agent, and then I directed four very mediocre, forgettable Hollywood movies, slasher, horror film, comedy, but at least it wasn't in the Christian community. And so it was a step up, even though it was in the worst part of the movie business. By the way, I wrote a novel. One of my many books that came out of that experience is called And God Said Billy. It's in paperback and also on Amazon. Not that we're here to talk about that, but it does go through the kind of correlation between the flakes I met in the movie business and the craziness in the evangelical world, which is another story. And then I wrote a novel in 1990 called Portofino, and that actually had tremendous success. It got a great review in the LA Times. Many other good reviews followed. It got translated into 9 languages, and that was about 15 books ago. And since then, I've written 4 more novels and a whole bunch of nonfiction works, including a memoir of mine called Crazy for God, which could have, the subtitle kind of sums up the thumbnail sketch I've just given you of my life here, because it's how I grew up as one of the elect, helped found the religious right, and lived to take all or almost all of it back. And then this book, Why I'm an Atheist Who Believes in God, came out of the correspondence that came out of that book with people like Christopher Hitchens, the new atheist author, who told me that he really liked the book, but He was very disappointed that I hadn't made a clear declaration at the end of it that I was part of the new atheist movement. And, of course, I was getting similar emails from my old evangelical friends saying, we really are disappointed. We like the way you told your story of your journey, and we can see why you got out, but why haven't you clearly affirmed you're a Christian? And so I was sitting there thinking, wow, you know, you change a word or two in Chris Hitchens' email or a word or two in something from an old evangelical colleague, and they both really come across like certainty addicts who are pissed off with me because I'm saying, hey, I've embraced paradox. I don't know. And that's where this book, Why I'm an Atheist Who Believes in God, subtitled How to Give Love, Create Beauty, and Find Peace, really came from. And now it's come out, and as you say, it's on Amazon, and it's in Barnes & Noble, or you can get it in Kindle and download it or any other form. So I've been out on the road talking about this book in libraries and schools and bookstores and doing shows like this.
Oh, great. Well, yeah,
long thumbnail sketch.
I was going to say that is a great summary. I mean, that is really, really kind of lets the listeners know exactly, you know, kind of the journey that you've taken so far, and
I didn't even tell you why Oprah interviewed me.
I know.
That was my
Oprah.
Big moment of fame. You know, I still haven't washed the hand that she shook. I mean, I'm hoping that she interviewed me on a whole other book called Keeping Faith, a Father-Son Story About Love in the United States Marine Corps, because in the middle of all this, I had a son go into the Marines and fight in Afghanistan, wrote a book about him, which became a New York Times bestseller after she interviewed me, blah, 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 blah. So it hasn't all been about this theological journey. I have had a life outside of that, and a lot of my books are, but now we're talking about why I'm an atheist who believes in God. So we're sticking
well,
with that.
But you know, but we're and I'm happy to talk about any of the other things. Your art, even. I mean, you know, you are a multifaceted man, no doubt. So, but
another word, desperate. A desperate man.
No,
that's the other word for when they say you're a Renaissance man, they just mean you're desperate. And you're, you know, you're like, hey, I've got a watch here you can buy if you won't buy my book.
Yeah. Well, you know, I did see that you were on Oprah, but I'll tell you, the selling point was I saw that you've been on Rachel Maddow. I thought, okay,
yes,
if he's
I
been
have.
On Rachel
many
Maddow.
Times, many times. Rachel's interviewed me a lot on these subjects.
Yeah, I know. So I thought, okay, if he's been on there, then Frank is good for me. So
good to go.
Okay, which tells you exactly my perspective of life.
Let's
start first of all with you know the idea of calling yourself an atheist, and
right.
you know the idea of simultaneously believing in that God exists and doesn't exist. You know, and
right.
I've kind of talked to a couple of people about that, and they're like, "Well, how can you simultaneously have opposing views such as existence?"
Right. Right. Well, first of all, a title is meant to pull you into the book and make you wonder, what the hell is this author all about? So that's good. It did its job. You took a look. But the second thing is to be serious for a moment. The heart of my book is an anti-labeling book. Look, let me put it this way. One of the things I say in my book is I've never met an atheist or a Christian. I've never met a black man or a white man. I've never met anybody who's gay or straight or male or female. I've never even met children or grown-ups. I've only met people on a journey who, excuse me, often change their minds and certainly can't be defined by one catch-all label because we're complex beings. Look, you know, let's look at who we really are. We're not Democrats or Republicans or black or white. We are biological machines with this weird quirk, and that is when we look out at the world through our eyes, we look out as spiritual beings who feel that we have personality, we have empathy, we have consciousness, and whether you call that spirituality or belief, you know, you can be a neuroscientist or a physicist and not buy into any kind of spiritual qualities at all and denounce them as mere figments of our brain chemistry and so forth, but you come home and your kid comes home from preschool and you still sweep her up and you say, I love you, and you mean something by that. And so this mystery, this paradox that cannot be summed up because it's bigger than we are in the sense that, you know, on the evolutionary scale where we are, you know, an eye blink ago, you and me were single-celled creatures floating around in the slime, and here we are talking about whether there's a God or not. you know, we basically just stood up long enough to learn that we're idiots. I mean, what do we know? The fact of the matter is, we're primitives. We all of us, I don't care who, from Einstein to me and all points in between, putting myself at the bottom of the chart, by the way, you know, we are just jumped up semi-evolved primates who are vicious a lot of the time. Which, by the way, is why atheists blaming religion for everything is insane, just like religious people blaming atheists for everything is insane. Our problem is that we're semi-evolved primates, as I put it in the book. So let's get real for a moment. And instead of summing up belief and unbelief in these huge, watertight terms, you know, as I said to a group of students at Oklahoma University a couple of months ago, I looked out at a very divided crowd because an atheist group had come. That's one thing my book does is it brings wacko combinations. It's like, you know, why I'm married and love divorce, you know, how I'm gay and terribly straight. I mean, how could I screw it up more than this? So I'm looking out at this atheist humanist club that's shown up en masse, and then a whole bunch of evangelicals who knew who my family was, and I thought, oh, this is good. You know, where's the door? But it all went fine. And I said to these guys, look, let me tell you one thing, no matter who you are and what you take away from here. There's a 22-year-old Southern Baptist in here who's sure he's going to give his life to Jesus and go out and save the world for God. I promise you, you know, 15 years from now, you're going to be a leading new atheist author. And there are people in here who have been reading Richard Dawkins, and you get the T-shirt and the coffee mug, and you've sent away for the bumper sticker. What do you know? One of you is going to wind up as a world-famous evangelist. There are women here who never want to have kids and just pursue career. You're going to have a baby and change your life. There are people here who think they're going to be married the rest of your life. You're going to get divorced. There are people who divorced who think they're never going to marry again. You will. Get real. You know, enough with the pronouncements. There's so much mystery and so much journey involved that what my title, Why I'm an Atheist Who Believes in God, is meant to do is to basically undermine this pompous kind of self-referential titling we give ourselves as if our labels define us. They do not. And it's not just because we change our minds. It's because in the quiet of the night, atheists pray. Sure they do. They think, wow, I'm so worried about my little girl. She's in the hospital. They're sending out a a message to the cosmos of longing. They don't give it an articulate voice. They don't say, dear Jesus. But that's what prayer is. They long for something beyond themselves to intervene and help them. And there are lots of pastors who are going to stand up on Sunday morning preaching sermons who don't believe a word of it. They're just there for the paycheck. So it doesn't even get into the area of sincerity and insincerity. So Why I'm an Atheist Who Believes in God is deliberately an anti-labeling book that just says, hey, let's all pretend for a minute we're on a desert island and we got a couple cases of beer and we're stark naked and we've decided to be honest together. We're not going to be sitting here making grand pronouncements about the universe and everything in it. We're just going to be trying to get through the day. And what I talk about in the book a lot is where my spirituality intersects with my grandchildren. I tell stories about Lucy and Jack and Nora and Amanda and Ben and what they mean to me. I'm not talking about theology. And then when I do get into what I believe about Jesus, it isn't a matter of belief like who is he or did he rise from the dead or any of this theological nonsense. It's, hey, look, is there a pattern of empathy here, as I put it in this book? Did Jesus plant an empathy time bomb in the evolutionary cycle? And I think he did. And so I still see great value in some of my Christian heritage. I don't see it in the theology. I don't think anybody's going to burn in hell forever if they don't get that right any more than I'd burn my grandchild. But I see value in it. So basically, this is a book that says to the evangelical Christian I came from or the Roman Catholics I used to know, hey, listen, you're a lot less certain than you thought you were. And if you're still certain at my age, like you were when you're 20, then you're a certainty addict. This is a mental problem, or as I put it in the book, religion is a neurological illness, and faith is the only cure. And that's meant to be contradictory. And the same goes for some of my new atheist friends, you know, who talk about the day that they deconverted as if it was a born-again experience and now everything's settled. Nothing's settled except for the second we're sitting here talking. So when we really look at our lives honestly, it's like trying to nail down the word love. You know, sometimes love means, okay, I brought my wife a cup of coffee in bed this morning. Sometimes love means we had a huge fight, one of us drove away, one of us came back, I apologize, and love today means we hate each other a little less than we did in the morning. And that's love too. So now you tell me that you've got a sweeping definition of what the word love or belief or God or faith means, And I'm telling you that it doesn't relate to the actual world we live in. It only relates to words about words about words about words, which after all are all metaphors. So when you cut to the chase, it's down in the emotions. It's down in the hunches we have. It's down in the feelings we have. Or as I put it in the book, this kind of sense of an offstage chorus where we can kind of hear the singing, but we don't really know where it is. That's where most of us live.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, that was one of the areas I liked about your book. You talked about when you were talking about the labels not meaning anything, and you know,
right.
And you know, one of the things you talked about is like, you know, who cares when someone's slapping your face what a label is, or you know,
right.
Who cares about a label when they're saving you from drowning? But it really gets back to the whole idea of what you're saying is it is who someone is and what they do at that moment is really what matters.
Yeah, and one of the things I do in the book is I say, you know, what do you think the parable of the Good Samaritan is about? Or put it in modern terms, if there's a Danish atheist bureaucrat in a Scandinavian country administering a healthcare system that leaves no one behind, or there's a Southern Republican congressman that the Tea Party's put there who wants to cut everybody's food stamps, has been consistently lying about Barack Obama because this Southern Baptist elder in his church is also a racist, and he treats women terribly and does not do anything for gay people or anyone else, or the least of these, as the Bible would defend them, then who's following Jesus, the atheist or the born-again Christian? Well, if you go to some of the words that are reputedly spoken by Jesus in the New Testament, you know, the atheist Danish bureaucrat who's actually taking care of people is following that empathy time bomb and doing something about it. Whether he gives credit there or not isn't the point. It's the actions and the content of the character. And the guy talking about Jesus a mile a minute, who's part of a political project that refuses to accept climate change, is going to run our planet into the ground while denying maternity leave to women because he doesn't believe in it, and health care being taken away from people, and has been lying about Barack Obama since day one because he can't stand the idea of a black man in the White House. You know, I don't care what his theology is. When you add it up and you say, hey, is this a mere image of a life built on following Jesus? It's not. So then the label doesn't matter. What matters is the truth of the situation, and I think that applies to everything. It's the same as love. I mean, you know, who would you rather have as your partner, you know, if you're married or you're gay or you're straight? You know, someone who consistently looks out for you, is kind and compassionate, or somebody who talks a lot about love and keeps dragging you off to marriage seminars, you know, and then comes home and beats the crap out of you. I mean, that's, you know, that's the deal, isn't it?
Exactly. Now, and actually, I have someone in the question in the chat room had a good question, and that was kind of the next thing: the idea of God. I mean, you talk about being an atheist who believes in God. So, what is your belief that God is? You know, you obviously you said it indicates that you do and you don't, or do you believe in God? I believe you do.
Depends on the day you catch me, but I mean, my most honest answer is I haven't a clue. It's just it's a word I use to express that I think there's more than meets the eye to our existence in this universe. And I'll just give you an idea of what I'm talking about, and I mentioned this in the book. I mean, look at our sense of scale. You know, Carl Sagan and people like him tell us we're very small. We're on a little mote of dust floating at the corner of a small galaxy lost in a universe. Maybe it's even a multiverse. And so we're very little and very insignificant. But if you flip it and say, well, wait a minute, we're contemplating the universe. The silent universe is not contemplating us. And I gain meaning because I tell my grandchildren stories. That's pretty big. It just depends what ruler you're measuring with. So, yeah, we're small compared to a 12-inch, you know, grade school ruler, but that seems pretty sophomoric and obvious to me. It doesn't really make us more or less meaningful. And so I think the same thing when I use the word God. I look at what the physicists tell us, and of course all this changes, but this, right now here's what they're saying, and I believe it's true, and that is that energy preceded matter. So that's a mind-blowing concept, that there was energy somehow without matter. Then out of that concentration of energy comes the matter, and then out of that matter, this tiny little pinpoint of matter, comes the Big Bang, and then here we all are, made of stardust billions of years later. Well, let's just call the energy that precedes the matter empathy or love. Now, why would I say something stupid like that? that sounds like it's out of a Reader's Digest article by some, you know, old fuddy-duddy who's, like, gone soft in the head. Because, you know, when you think of consciousness coming out of unconscious molecular structures, and out of consciousness comes this insane empathy, yes, there are evolutionary reasons for it, but that still doesn't explain why this happened. And so I'm not talking about intelligent design or any of this business. I'm just saying I look at my grandchildren as a biological primate, and sure, you know, I want to be the silverback controlling my tribe. But then on the other hand, I look at the arc of how I've learned to be a far better grandfather than a father, because I'm far less harsh, and I've dumped the stupid Calvinist theology that told me I was supposed to be in charge of my house and women were going to be subservient and all this nonsense. And so I've grown and learned, and I just look at these conceptions of God that theologians propose that are going to burn people forever if they get details of theology wrong, and I'm saying, wow, you know, I'm an asshole a lot of the time. And, you know, if I, in the arc of 62 years and 40-some years of fatherhood, can learn to be so much kinder, are you telling me that if there is some sort of creator or cosmic force behind all this, give it whatever name you want, that it's stupider and less empathetic than me, then where does this level of empathy in me come from? It's as if you had found a new kind of subatomic particle that that can't be measured and yet actually binds everything together. And so when I simply look at what I feel is the purpose-filled nature, by chance or otherwise, that comes through evolution, culminating in where we're at now, which is just a way station, by the way. We're on our way to something else. We aren't evolved. We are evolving. But right now, even though we only stood up a millisecond ago in geological time, let alone universe time, you know, we've got this crazy sense of empathy. And we can sit here and argue about art and music and whether U2's new album is good and get passionate about it. This is way past what we need for survival. This is way past what we need for tribal cohesion. Art. Holy shit. We're going to argue about art. You know, I think Damien Hirst is an idiot. Other people think he's a genius. We get all excited about it. What's this got to do with tribal cohesion and the evolutionary village? The same thing with this sense of longing, this sense of an offstage presence. So call it whatever you want. But we're stuck with words, we're stuck with the English language, so I slapped the word God on my book, and you know, people can fill in the blank.
Okay, that's great. Well, gosh, we're halfway through the show, Frank. I want to take just a couple-minute break here.
Sure.
I do invite people to call in with questions, so if someone wants to call in, I can screen calls. The number is 619-789-4359. And then those of you listening in the chat room, if you'd like for me to pose a question to Frank, feel free to type it in there. And then when we come back, Frank, I want to talk a little bit about Holly Mead. And, you know, she obviously played a role in your belief system because her creed is part of your book subtitle. So I'd like to talk about her a little bit when we come back, okay?
Will do, will do.
Great. Okay, everyone stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Hi, it's Maya at Mind Over Matter in Nyack, New York. I'd just like to take a moment to share with you how amazing I found Robert Sharpe's book, Joy Potential. It kind of found me at a time when I was feeling out of sorts and overwhelmed and I guess derailed by the pressures of my career and my large family and caregiving and ailing husband. I just really felt like my spark was dimming. It was a perfect time for me to pick up Joy Potential because as I just in the first few pages began to read, I found that my frame of mind wasn't so different from others dealing with challenges and the trials and tribulations of life. I guess my first feeling was that I wasn't alone, and with that I began to open more to receive the message that Robert gave of light and love and positive thinking. That's what Joy Potential is all about. His thoughts are beautifully written, and everyone, whether you're going through your own personal challenges, should read it. His message was certainly well received from me, and I'm thankful for his insight and his caring and really helping me to get back on track. I think everyone should put Joy Potential on the top of their reading list. Love and light. Thank you.
For more information or to purchase your copy of Joy Potential, visit www.joybook.me. That's joybook.me.
Okay, everyone, thank you for staying with us. And again, thank you to Maya for that testimonial. I appreciate that. Okay, back to today's show. And again, my very special guest today is Frank Schaefer, author of Why I Am an Atheist Who Believes in God, How to Give Love, Create Beauty, and Find Peace. And again, Frank's book is available from Amazon.com in many forms, as well as many of his other books. So just click on the link I have in the show page description, take you right directly to his book. And then if you want to see his other books there, just click on his name, and you'll get a whole list. So with that, we're back, Frank.
Hey.
Hey, okay. All righty. Well, one of the things that I liked, you know, there was a couple references of people that you had met in your book. The one
sure.
was Camilla.
Right.
And the other one was Holly Mead. And
right.
Holly Mead, her creed, life creed, was give love, create beauty, and find peace. So I'd love to hear a little bit more about Holly, and maybe if you could just share with us a little bit about how her life exemplified that.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, I'm glad you bring her up because I folded her into the book. She was a wonderful friend of ours, and Jeannie and I knew her for 20-some years and watched her two children grow up. But unfortunately, Holly, a couple of years ago, died. She had a very quick, terrible, vicious cancer. And she was an incredibly talented artist. She was one of America's best children's books illustrators, won the Helen Caldicott Award, and so forth and so on. I was always very fond of her. She liked my writing, and we followed each other's work. But Holly was one of these people who really had this spiritual sense that I think transcended all these arguments, the arguments between the new atheists and Christians and all these other people, and went to a completely different place where her life was dedicated to the creation of beauty. She was an incredibly peaceful, lovely person. You know, she would call me up all excited that if she had seen wildlife in her garden up there in Maine where she lived. She was just a very guileless, straightforward, lovely woman. And, you know, when she died, she met her death with such equanimity and peacefulness. As a young woman, she was only in her early 50s. I mean, this was incredibly sad. But instead of any bitterness or anything like that, you know, she was just sitting there working on her woodcuts and putting together her next art show, really right up to the moment almost she passed away. And the thing is, what happened with Holly's death is that it kind of dovetailed with me losing my mom, who died at a much older age, at 98 years old. And on the way home from mom's funeral, I met this wonderful opera singer on the airplane by the name of Camilla Tilling, who became friends with Jeannie and I after that. But it was one of these crazy coincidences, as a kind of serendipity run wild, where Camilla not only invited me to come to the concert she was giving in Boston the next night, which was Mahler's Second Symphony, but Mahler's Second Symphony is his putting to music a poem that he wrote about what he thought it would be like to have a first day in heaven. Now, my fundamentalist evangelical mom was nothing if not a literal believer in heaven. And I may or may not be, depending on the day. But let me tell you this, it was awfully hard to imagine that my mother, if she was aware of what was going on, would not have been very pleased and may have had something to do with it. So as I put in the book, look, you know, mom was a classical music aficionado. She bought tickets to classical concerts all through my childhood, even when there was no money in the mission for anything else. And if she had designed the perfect, you know, seatmate on a plane for me coming home from her funeral, it would have been to meet an opera singer who would then invite me to a performance of a piece of music my mother loved about getting to heaven. It was just sort of so crazy and weird that I was really stunned. And okay, so I'm an old softie, but I was sitting there in the concert, and literally when Camilla came on to sing so beautifully, she's really a wonderful singer, you know, I was sitting there just going, thank you, Mom. Now, was she hearing me? I don't know. But this is where I'm an atheist who believes in God. Or put it this way, I'm someone who believes my dead mother intervenes on my behalf, and I don't believe in the afterlife. So go figure and deal with it. You know, just like there are times I don't want to be married, but I stay married. Just like there's times I don't want to be a father or grandfather, and I am. And, you know, this is the human condition. There are times when you feel this spiritual sense strongly, other times not at all. But anyway, the reality of some of these experiences that I share in the book, I think, is true for a lot of people. It's nothing unique to me. And these little divine interventions, whether they are really or not, but they certainly feel that way, are a part of most people's lives, you know. And that includes PhD candidates in astrophysics who don't believe anything, but still send up a little prayer before they sit the exam. And that's just how we feel. And if they feel lucky enough to meet their old tutor, who happens to be one of their, you know, thesis supervisors, then they sort of look up and say, hey, thanks. And maybe they don't believe in a divinity, or they do, but we all certainly operate as if there are other forces in our life that we can't control that intervene in good and bad ways. And I think most people sense that.
Yeah, I agree. Now, you know, speaking of, you know, feeling one way or being, you know, another, you talked about in your book that generally we are all of more than one mind, you know, that,
right.
And, you know, and you had an interesting reference in there where you talked about, you know, Billy Graham earlier in the show. You talked about how he would kind of socialize with you, but
right.
that he, you know, preached salvation and guaranteed heaven, but stated he feared death and had doubts. So,
yeah,
to me,
I mean, he would ask my dad
yeah.
for counsel. They met each other at Mayo Clinic quite a bit, because Billy Graham was the world's greatest hypochondriac, and I think that's not bad-mouthing, because everybody who knows him knows it. I mean, he was in there getting checked out, you know, all the time. I mean, all the time. And this is like years ago when he was in perfectly good health. And my dad was there for chemotherapy for his lymphoma, and they would meet and talk, and Billy would tell him quite honestly and quite often how much he feared death. And So look, I'm not disrespecting him for that. I'm saying that doesn't make him less sincere. I don't know whether he's sincere or not. But the point being, it's never quite as simple as what it's cracked up to be. So it's just like talking to political leaders that, you know, in the dark of the night, these Republican idiots who are going to shut our government down again if they don't get their way on sending everybody home across the southern border, you know, these people are threatening to it. Don't tell me that they don't know quietly within their soul that they're idiots sometimes and they're just playing a political game to get the votes of other idiots. Look, they know that, and so do evangelical preachers who don't really believe in hellfire and damnation, but they say they do because otherwise they can't pull their paycheck. So this kind of thing that I talk about and why I'm an atheist who believes in God in terms of my own journey out of the evangelical world, it isn't only to do with flakes who aren't sincere. It even has to do with the most sincere people who are atheists or religious or all points in between who look, you know, we all have doubts about what we think we believe at any given moment. And as we get older, unless we're really crazy, we should have more doubt and more uncertainty because we know we've changed our mind before. So the things we thought, say, as parents that were absolutely necessary to do with children, we now know we were wrong. It's no longer just a matter of opinion. We see that that was completely crazy, and we didn't need to correct them so much. And now we're grandparents, say, in my case, and we do it less, and everything still works out fine or better. So we learn. So I think, you know, when you look at these issues, one mistake we make is by lifting questions of belief and philosophy and religion into some special highfalutin category. It's really just part of our life. It's like making love so complicated nobody dares to have a relationship, or sexuality so weirdly complex with so many competing voices telling you what you're supposed to do or not do that, you know, you know nobody can have orgasms because they're like so worried about it. I mean, that's not how real life works. We've got to just realize that, you know, there's always complexity, there's always paradox. We never have enough information to make these big decisions, and people who say they do are either very young, very foolish, or lying. There is no other kind of person who's certain about these huge issues.
Yeah, that's, you know, one of the things that I found interesting in your book. You talked about your parents' deluded fundamentalist certainties. You know, that's the one thing that sometimes, you know, when I see, you know, the extreme right, you know, just spouting certainty when it's just, I'm like, wait a minute, you know, there's, when you think about the just looking at the world and
right.
the divergent views and the different belief systems that
right.
And the fact of the topics being spoken can't truly be stated with certainty. You know
right.
what I mean? I mean, it's like
right.
no one can truly say what happens after we die. I mean,
yeah, or even what
certainty.
Happens 5 minutes after this show's over.
Exactly.
You know, hey,
exactly.
forget dying. I mean, that may be the same thing, but I mean, you know what I'm saying? Look at our real situation. I mean, we are clueless. People say, oh, well, why did you marry Jeannie? Well, because in 6 months I hadn't come up to the dining room and I decided to eat there that night with the rest of the community. She walked in the door and I happened to have Abbey Road downstairs in my studio and she hadn't heard it. Boom. You know, 45 years later, 3 kids and 5 grandchildren, here we are. What was the big theological reason, the message from God? You know, I've said this in the book, I think, and I certainly will say it here. You know, the only thing that I have sufficient information about to make a rational decision on is the purchase of small household appliances. Everything else is a mystery to me. And the bigger the question, who to marry, where to live, what work to do, what your partner should be if you're not going to get married, whether to stay celibate or not celibate, sexual activity, having babies, not having babies, you know, what you believe, God existing, not existing, religion, the church you join, it's all circumstances. Let's tell the truth. Would I be talking about Jesus if I had been born in 10th century China? You know, would we be having this conversation if we had both been the sons of imams in Riyadh in the 15th century? No. So let's be honest here. It isn't that we've come to these great conclusions. You know, Richard Dawkins knows things. He's read all these books. It's as if somehow it's divinely revealed knowledge. This is the truth. It has to do with the fact that he was a professor in England in the 20th and 21st century when certain ideas were current, certain things were respectable. People say, well, why do I still go to church when I have all these doubts and unbelief? Because my mother raised me that way. You know, you got a problem with that? What better reason do you have? When we come down to the real reasons we do things, they're not the big intellectual constructs of reason as much as, hey, man, I just happened to be standing there and a rock fell on me. I happened to be in the dining room and I saw this pretty girl. I was lonely and strung out and whatever it was, and Billy Graham preached this sermon and I got all emotional and went forward and accepted Jesus. Now, that didn't happen to me, but, hey, that's how it happens. Then all of a sudden you're committed to your label. Because now you're running around saying, I am a Christian, I'm a Democrat, I'm a gay rights activist. And now if you have doubts, you can't crawl back because this is your identity, this is your ego. And in the case of a lot of religious people, it's your paycheck. So don't expect any honest discussions about this is all I'm telling you. It's a bunch of vested interests and circumstances. And if we were all honest, we'd be a lot less certain about what we were saying.
Yeah, that was the one thing I'm certain about with your book is that uncertainty is what it's all about. One of the things that you talked about your mom a little bit, and I know that you know your book starts off with you kind of returning after the funeral, returning home after the funeral,
right.
and that all of the wonderful kinds of letters and everything that you received afterwards. But one of the descriptions you used about your mom was calling her gloriously inconsistent.
Right.
You know, can you talk a little bit about that? Because you know, I think I'm curious as to how she, in your view, reconciled some of the the sermons and the teachings. Because
sure.
you said that she was believed in the Bible literally, but
right.
then again, there were a lot of actions that she did which. Weren't
sure.
necessarily inconsistent. Okay, so can you talk a little bit about
that?
Yeah,
well, gloriously inconsistent, gloriously hypocritical, totally a better person than her theology. God bless her. I mean, literally, look, let me give you a concrete example. Mom believed in the Bible literally, and she believed in a very strict Calvinist interpretation of that Bible. But how did she treat gay people who came to her ministry of Libri through the 50s and 60s and 70s, long before it was fashionable to talk about homosexuality, which is how it was termed then? in compassionate terms. Did she throw them out? Did she tell them they had to change? Did she say they were living lives of sin? Did she say if they accepted Jesus, they would change, that they could pray away the gay, that they weren't welcome? I'll tell you how she treated them. My dad's secretary was a lesbian. The girl she roomed with in our house, these were 40-year-old women, for 12 years while I was growing up was a lesbian. What do you think was going on in that room? Did my parents throw them out? No. Did other Libri workers tell my parents, hey, you should do something about this? Yes, because they were the hard-nosed kind of people. And my dad said, it's none of my business. Anne is a good secretary. What's it to you? Now, how does that jive with the great mystery of his Calvinist theology? It jives because he was a better person in his theology. In fact, the way I would put it is that he had actually gotten the message of Jesus' empathy time bomb, and it had gone off in his life. And actually, what I talk about in the book is that when Jesus was confronted with people who said, hey, the law says, the Bible says, the Torah says, which is what the law was in his day, he always came back with this wonderful phrase, yes, but, B-U-T. Here's what I'm telling you. So the law says stone this woman. Yeah, but I'm telling you we're not going to do that. The law says don't touch lepers. Well, I just did. The law says don't touch dead people. I just touched one. The law says don't touch whores. I let one pour perfume on me. The law says have nothing to do with these filthy scum Samaritans who don't believe right. Well, guess what? I'm talking to one. The law says women are second-class citizens. Jesus tells Mary and Martha to come out of the kitchen, quit doing women's work, and talk to him as an equal. He, you know, the example set there presents people who, like my parents, who believe all this stuff literally, with a problem. And I'll put it in a nutshell. In practical life, if you're an evangelical Christian, you can either believe in the Bible or follow Jesus. You can't do both, because his life contradicts the Bible. And he literally contradicted it in his sermons when he said, this is what the Bible says, which was the Torah, but here's what I'm telling you. And so my parents didn't work that out. They didn't talk about it. But they lived as if what I'm telling you right now was true. And so the people who came to their ministry were treated decently and with compassion and love and kindness and all the rest of it. And when I got Jeannie pregnant when we were 17 and 18, my mom and dad didn't sit me down and say, you got to marry her now. And they didn't say, she's got to leave or go put the baby up for adoption. They just said, hey, we'll give you guys a place to stay till you work things out. Well, wow, yeah. Man. This is compassion. This is civil, beautiful behavior. So, you know, what I talk about in my book is my mother's glorious hypocrisy, her inconsistency, her wonderful two-facedness. And you know, the wonderful thing is so many people operate like that. There are secular atheists who are totally hard-assed when it comes to things like human emotion and feeling in terms of what they think about it scientifically. They still treat their wives as if love is real. They still treat people with altruism and kindness, even if they think evolution explains it away. You know, thank goodness that we all actually have an overriding system in our neurological pathways in our brain, which says, hey, listen, you know what? No matter what you believe, you can't do that. So, yeah, you know, we're a racist country, and we've been terrible to Barack Obama. But still, when a young black man who with his hands up gets shot in the back of the head, it causes a stink. Because even though we suck, intuitively, a lot of people have a kind of a fair gene in their body that no matter what their politics is, they're saying, well, shit, this isn't good. So that's the blessed hypocrisy of empathy overriding whatever our constructed prime directive and label is. And my mom was sure a person like that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, she sounds like she would have been, just from the responses that she got from people of her display of kindness,
right,
and her priorities, obviously she was at least walking the walk, you know what I mean?
Right,
and
she was walking the walk, talking the talk.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, and my
exactly.
dad was cruising around with all these guys who literally became billionaires. I mean, literally, in the case of, for instance, Pat Robertson, billionaires on the, quote, Lord's work. And here dad's working in an old rocking chair on the side of his bed on a tray, doesn't even have an office, never owned a car.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there are a lot of people in the evangelical world I come from, like my father, who have a lot of integrity and are individually wonderful people. The only trouble is they've hooked into a theology which, when it's politicized by people like the Tea Party and the Republicans these days, becomes a monstrosity, because it's, you know, it's like the Bible without Jesus in it. It's basically, okay, we don't care what Jesus said. It reverses it. It's just, let's go to the law here and hit everybody over the head with the book.
Yeah, exactly. Boy, guys, we're kind of getting through. We've only got 10 more minutes left, and I just can't leave the show without talking about prayer. obviously, I talked about you're an atheist who prays. And,
right, I'm an atheist who prays.
I would love, if you wouldn't mind sharing with the listeners, you have an interesting prayer in the morning ritual,
yeah.
I guess?
I joined the Greek Orthodox Church almost 25 years ago, but was interested in it for the last 30. And it has a very ancient liturgical cycle. And again, you know, I say these words, I don't say I know what they mean, or I explain them, or other people don't say them, or, you know, lost in some way. But, you know, the most ancient prayer of the church is Lord Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy upon me. And I get up that and say that, and I say that, I repeat that. It's like a sort of a mantra almost. And then, Lord, I offer you this day. And I walk down my stairs from my attic bedroom, and I pray for each family member on the staircase. And my little granddaughter Lucy knows which is her stair, and always sits there and says, remember to pray for me. And, you know, and this pays off, by the way. The other day, when after she had learned that my mom had died because she was very old, as I kept telling her, and Jeannie's mother had died too, and we told her she's very old, I was walking up my driveway, and Lucy said to me, Ba, she calls me Ba, B-A, next time you pray, you ask God to make you grow old very slowly. And so, you know, that's not going to happen outside of a sense that a child has, that there's something that can be done about these big issues. And I'm not going to take that away from her, and I'm not going to let anybody take away from me the comfort I get from a morning ritual, remembering my family in what I take to be loving terms. Now, for me, because of my background, my psychology, because I'm Edith Schaefer's son, not somebody else's son, my period of history I'm born in, I'm in the West, my moment in time, my way of couching things in a spiritual, meaningful, loving, caring way is to put them in a religious-sounding framework. But that doesn't mean that I'm walking down those stairs saying, if you don't start your day this way, you will burn in hell forever. If you don't if you don't say these words, you don't believe what I believe. I'm just saying, hey, look, this is me. I like Byzantine liturgies. I like unfooled around with Shakespeare plays. You know, here are the rock bands I like. Here's the classical music I like. I didn't tell you you have to like this. They give my life value. And I'm not going to strip the things that give your life meaning away from you with some silly argument, because it's not the way I see it, and I don't expect other people to do that to me. And that's where I get off the boat with evangelicals telling people they're going to go to hell if they don't accept Jesus, or atheists telling people they're stupid if they walk down their stairs in the morning praying for their grandchildren. You know, I just don't buy it. So, you know, that's how I see it. And I think it meets a need, though, that brings up a really big question, and that is, if we have these impulses, maybe it's because there's really something there. Now, that I said maybe. I didn't say there is. But I leave the door open. I leave the door open. I really hope there's something in the universe who can hear my thoughts. Wouldn't that be nice? You know, wouldn't that be great that if we're not completely alone, and that, you know, beyond the edge of the beyond, there's more? And why not? So that's where I leave it.
Yeah. Well, now, you know, you actually referenced it in your book, that scientific experiment about mice, about how, you know, it was a fear in one mouse was passed on genetically to a child.
Another mouse.
Another mouse. You know, to me, the idea of prayer, you know, or even, you know, the whole idea of even, you know, aversion to whatever, you know, positive or negative, all of that, to me, I believe, does influence our DNA. So, I mean, in essence, even if my thought is, even if your prayers don't go to God, or you know, to
or whatever,
to whomever
is there,
or whatever, that the positive thought, the empathy, the compassion, and all that is passed on, you know.
Yeah, and I think it also has a very nurturing thing, in the sense that you know, if you have been walking down your stairs you know, holding up the name of each person in your family you love and feel responsible for, later that day when you're all pissed off with everybody, you're a lot less likely to do something stupid and smack someone or yell at them or whatever, because your mindset is, hey, look, man, I'm responsible to something larger than myself here. This is these are the people I'm committed to. These are the thoughts I'm committed to. So it's a discipline. It's not just a question of, oh, is anybody hearing me? It's a way of looking at reality that's not completely self-centered. Hey, you know, you say thank you before you eat. You pray for your granddaughter. If someone gets sick, you don't just say, hey, you know, I'm sending you my best thoughts. You say, hey, look, I was raised a certain way. This isn't happy holidays. I'm going to wish you a Merry Christmas. I was raised a certain way. I'm going to tell you I'm praying for you. You know, I'm far more touched by someone telling me who they really are, what's from the bottom of their heart. You know, if an atheist friend of mine, and I have many, and I don't mean generic like, oh, some of my best friends are atheists. I mean literally my best friends. If they say to me, hey, Frank, you know I can't wish you a Merry Christmas. I don't believe in any of this shit. But hey, I love you so much. I wish I could. You know, and I totally get what you're doing. That means so much more to me than a sort of a generic happy holiday. Everybody should just be who they are. And if you have something deep and wonderful to tell someone, hey, just tell them you love them the way you tell them you love them. And for me to say I love you or I'm thinking of you if you're sick or something is for me to say, hey, I'm going to pray for you. If you turn around and say, do you think God will answer the prayer? I'll say, I don't have a clue. And there's no way to know, and I don't even know if God's there. I just told you I'm doing my bit the way I was raised to see things to let you know that I actually care about this. And that, right. That I think, is the bottom line.
I agree. Well, I do hope that your aging slows so that, like Lucy wanted you to see her kids be 12 years old. Was that correct?
Right. She said, I asked her how long I was supposed to live, and she says, until my daughter, and she pauses and says, is 12. She's
so,
six, by the way, Lucy is.
Yeah, so hopefully that'll be a long, long time. Exactly. Well, Frank, you know, before we close, any final words? What do you hope that your book is going to stimulate in the reader? What would I take from it? Just questioning?
Sure. You know, no, I like the emails I'm getting from the book. I get emails from atheists who say, hey, listen, you've really given me pause. I've never thought of spirituality this way before. New thoughts. And I really love getting the letters from embittered former evangelicals who are totally burnt out and really just had such a bad experience with religion, who write and say, hey, you know, this has healed me. You've told some of my story here. I get this. So that kind of nurturing of a better discussion about truth and religion and faith and hope and love and mercy, charity, these things, you know, this is what I hope people take away. I don't want them to say, oh, he's right, I buy all of this. I don't, you know, that's not the point. It's not trying to convert anybody. It's just saying, hey, there is a better way to look at these issues than the polarized confrontation between atheism and belief. That's what I want them to take away.
Great. Well, Frank, this has really been a wonderful chat. I really appreciate your time. I enjoyed your book. It was very easy reading and light, but also very thought-provoking, too. So I appreciate it.
Hey, you know what? I appreciate that you took the time to really read it and ask such lovely questions so that I could talk about my book. And, you know, this is a nice
welcome shot.
Thanks a lot.
Great. You're very welcome.
Okay. Well,
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, everyone, again, today my very special guest has been Frank Schaefer, author of Why I Am an Atheist Who Believes in God, How to Give Love, Create Beauty, and Find Peace. And again, I do have a direct link to Frank's book, which is available at Amazon.com in the show page description. So everyone, thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. And until we meet again.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. Be sure to visit our website at www.biteradio.me. That's biteradio.me. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Byte Radio Me. And our shows are also available as a free podcast from iTunes. And until we meet again, remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.